I want to mention that of all the stories of Sosavanta that I've come across, written by authors, this, I mean, about him, about his work, of course, the largest single work is this. It's the most famous about that type, which I mentioned. I don't know if I mentioned this. A mistake, I brought the second Chaluk to the first. This is two-volume Chaluk, the second. I regard this, my humble opinion, is the best work on Rabbi Yisrael, because it works essentially with his own Kesuvim. Excerpts are very well organized. And Shlomo Sarant, this was a grandson of his, the Rav Chaim Yitzchak Lipkin. There are two volumes. This is an excellent work. I don't know, but it's an old, hundreds of years ago, just put out 54 by Netzach. You have to ask him, it was put out by Netzach, so you know how to identify. Then you ask someone. He also, this Rav Lipkin, is the author of a five-volume work, Encyclopedia of Mitzvahs, which is excellent. Geography, then, it's warm, it's inspired, it's not a study of the Shittas HaMusa, but it does convey hundreds of ideas and words which you can get an aura. And push it for one's own Ischaskus, that's for Rada, it's excellent. Everything he did, by the way, is very inspired. And it's well, he's out there, that's from Shamas, he's up already, he lives in Yerushalayim. I don't know if he has a kind of a serious follower here in Eretz Yisrael, but he deserves it. But everything he wrote is very, very well done. But this is not really an analysis of Eretz Yisrael and his teachings. And that's what we want to try to do. Because we first have to take a look at his, a little bit of his history. And for that, I'm helping myself with an outline of his history. Life with the Torah Samusabah of Dead Cats. Those of you who have gone through this will find most of this, I imagine, familiar. The best we can do is to review it and to try to do it as succinctly as we can. Rabbi Salanter was born in Tavkuf Ayin, equivalent to 1810. Not so long after the Ptira of the Grove. He was born in a town called Zager, which, if you take a look at the geographic map, for this, what I'm about to say now, it's a conjecture. I didn't see this in any authoritative source, except in one essay by his name now. He was a later German Jewish Orthodox, writer, historian. I mean, I'm not quoting him in this context because I generally side with his point of view. But in this one matter, he has an enlightening insight. The town of Zagier was on the boundary between Lithuania and Latvia. The character and culture of the local populations is a blend between the East European, Russian, Polish outlook and makeup, psychological makeup, and the German. Lithuanian Jewry was, in general, calm in manner, mentally keen, intellectually inclined, by which I don't mean secular intellectualism. I mean, in Yahadus, they were Torah Jews of the mind, not given to easy enthusiasm, not given to easy emotionalism, solid. A lot of Yashuas in the earlier generations among them, until they clashed with the Haskalah, was a different story. But side by side with this prime characteristic of love of learning, was also characterized by a lot of chesed, a lot of tmimus in their interhuman relations. This is the background, the Lithuanian Jewish background, in a few simple words. But in that area of Lithuania, which was right near Latvia, there was another influence. There was a German influence too. The German influence began to inject, led to the infiltration of echoes of what was happening in the West. And in the West, it was the age of the explosion of reform came just 10 years later. Out of Shmad, a monumental struggle between the old Jewish world and the new emancipation. Echoes of that started infiltrating. The Jews who came from that area were in inner feeling and thinking something of a blend. They were essentially East European Jews. But there was an openness, a greater openness to Western cultural interests. They were more aware, some of them because of business reasons. They traveled a lot into East Prussia for commerce. And they were made sensitive to what was happening over there. And also to a certain type of German energy, ambition. I mean, it's hard for me to formulate it more precisely. It also blended into the character of the Jews living in that area. It was there that Rebbe Yisroel was born. Much of his later breadth of interest and his sensitivity to the conflicting currents of East and West, to which most of his contemporaries were not that keen. They were not aware of it, but it was affecting them. And he, with his genius and his brilliance, his godless, he had like a seismograph into him. He picked up, his antenna picked up a lot of things that most other people didn't even see, but was going to happen. It was going to explode 30 years later, 40 years later. He saw it earlier. This helps to provide an insight into some of the things that at least that triggered his interests and his efforts. At the age of 12, his father felt that he should go away to learn elsewhere, should be Mekane of the Galilean Kantor. And his father was a ranking Talmid Chacham, was one of the great Talmid Chachamim of the age, but for his vocation, he was a simple Melamed. Melamed was Jonah. He taught his own child. Of course, it's a mark of the extent to which Torah had become widespread in the Lithuania of 30 years, only 10 years after the Goyim's Ptira, but just decades after the Goyim's activities. Very close to the founding of Alojan. It's a mark of the Torah richness of those communities that very big Talmid Chachamim just wandered around, weren't recognized, were not Rabbonim, were not Rosh Yeshivas. And there were thousands of Jews like that. I think I once told you that Kutki Vege, about 1830, traveled through Vilna, the Goyim city, on the way to a chasana of one of his children in Poland. He had a son in Warsaw of Shlomega. On the way to a chasana of one of his children, traveled through Vilna, so wherever Tiberia went. So of course there were tremendous Kabbalah's problems, tremendous outpouring of Kabbalah. And Vilna Kehila decided that even though since the Ptir of the Goen, which was really only 1798, just 30 years or so earlier, but since the Ptir of the Goen, there wasn't going to be any more Rov in Vilna. Be a Vada Rabbonim, but not a Dayan, Moira Hero, and maybe a Rosh Bezdin, a Magid, but not the Magidim there. I told you who also once were also the Gedolim B'Torah. But it wasn't going to be a Rov, except the Kedayim. So they thought, he's worthy of it. So they tried to, you know, to inveigle him, and he was considering it. Now, he was being taken to some event for some Kabbalah's Ponim, and all of the Aglonim, all of the, the Balagolas, the coach drivers, the wagon drivers, all vied for the honor of taking him. And finally, well, a few of them won together. Neither would let go. So it looks like, I'm not clear on this, two or three were up on the driver's seat, or taking turns whipping the horses, and here's a Kireya sitting inside, and his ear suddenly catches that these wagon drivers, they know Shas. He heard Shas being hurled about. So when he got to his destination, so he told the Roshim of the Vilna Kehila, I can't be a Rov in a city in which the wagoneers know Shas, in which there are wagoneers. Be forgiven, he was also not Rov. He couldn't. He tells a story about the Kireyos Gadlos and his Akoponim. It's the world in which the father of Rumsos Salanta functioned. Never acknowledged. At the age of 12, he sends him to one of the leading Gainam of the age, Tzvi Broida of Salant, who was, he was a colleague, but there was a lot of sending of Chiddush HaTorah, Kireyos and him, forwards and backwards, so you can sense from that who he was. But the Kireya used to call him in Yiddish the Groyser Rebbe Reb Tzvi, the big Rebbe Reb Tzvi. Okay, now this is where the Kireya was then the Rov of Salam. This is where this 12-year-old was brought. No, there was a lot of, when he took him into his kibbutz, so he had seven talmidim, and then every one of them became a Goel B'Yisur. Time. They were already before summer. He was a kid. Rebbe Sol was then 12 years old. So the Rebbetzin was upset. Mothers were upset. Why are you paying so much attention? So the Rebbetzin once said, within the hearing of this young Bochur, she said to her husband, what are you putting in all your kirchas to the son of this one, the son of that Malamed? She didn't know who Rebbe Sol's father was, who he was. So he got upset for the covet of his father. So he said to her, "Mein Tata der Malamed can mehr lernen wie Asach Rabon. My father, the Malamed, is more of a Malamed than many Rabon." So she threw him out of the house. So the mother of three started pacifying her. She should let him in the house. She said, "No, you're more than that." So she would watch, he shouldn't get it. He would take him in through a window. He would appear, the kid would fly. until one time, I have to tell you about this, that he learned the Amida. Most of the hours of the day, the night that he learned standing for 30 years. So he became crippled on his legs. So he couldn't continue that way. That was the first ever spatoira. Because a time came when the Rebbetzin had to make sholem with his dialect. He learned there a number of years, and he mastered Shas through Alfis. He learned the whole Rif. Several years, he was still a young boy. I don't know exactly the age, he was a teenager. And a Goyen came in one day to spend to talk and learning them. Shalom, he got all the Tzibroida. And Tzibroida involved this Yelid, and that Goyen was upset, and putting me up against the Yelid like this. So after they talked to Lenin, and he acquired the name then, the Kleiner Alfis. the small ring, Alfasi HaKotel. That was a nickname that Rabbi Yisrael was given in his teens. Not widely known. There's these tidbits that tell something. And then the Rebbe said, once heard that this yellow ring was a little ring from a little office. So her own husband then said to her, "Did you see what others say about him?" So you can see that it's from him, that when he took out for the covet of his father, that you shouldn't get angry with him. You make shalom with him, and he didn't have to go through the window. Now, at the age of 14, he composed a choveres with Chiddush HaTorah, and he sent it to Rav Kiveri. And, you know, he indicated that he was a child. He was just young, but he was hoping that the Chiddush HaTorah would find favor in Kiveri's eyes. But Kiveri didn't answer. So, there are two versions of this. One is that he wrote that he was very young. The other that he didn't write about his age. But the Kiveri didn't answer. That's according to all the versions. Then, once a leader of London from Salant visited Posen and went to see Kiveri. So Kiveri took advantage of this visit to tell him that he had received some kind of a choveres with extraordinary, goyne is the Chiddush HaTorah, from some London here you have to apply the two versions, in Salant, and he didn't answer him. Why? Because he was afraid. He thought to himself, there is such a great Goyne as a Tzviboy, the Rosh Hashanah. So why doesn't this London deal with him? He probably wants to make it hard for him. He's probably trying to compete with him. And he must be unfriendly to him. So he thought, that's what he wrote to me. So I should become a partner to this. Careful, there was the covered so that's why he didn't answer. Then he found out, after all, this was only a yelet. And I think that Tzivoy knew that he was writing to Kiveri, so then it was a good answer. For 18 years, he learned in Salant. He was married already by this time, but I want to get to the Nekuda of his life. During those years, there were very few of the Shoinim and Achoinim available in most Bokim and Roshim, certainly not in private homes of London. And most London learned either Machshor or Pnei Yeshua style. They had very few of the Shoinim and Achoinim, except those that were printed in the rear of the Shasim. But the learning, the Ikir, even the greatest Talmid HaChachamim, was Al HaSar, on the spot. The Ikir was Rashi Tosfos, Machshor, and some had Pnei Yeshua. And for 18 years' time, Rabbi Yisrael learned like that. One of the characteristics of that style of learning was that the later method of Reb Chaim, conceptualization, was not yet then widely known. There was a few, Dafke in Galicia, there was the Pesach Hashem. A little bit later, about 1830s, the Menchas Chinuch, who were Dafke there in a country that was very foreign to the later, very alien to the later Reb Chaim Derech. But it was Dafke those two among the Achayim who laid down the foundations for the later development of conceptualization and learning. Anybody who takes a look at either the Ktzos or the Chinuch sees that that's their whole method. It's analytic, it's conceptual, it's atomic. It goes down to the root of everything. The earlier Derech HaLimud was not conceptual, it was textual, and it dealt largely with, not even with comparing texts from other Gemaras, except comparing texts, but Marshal Pnei Yeshua style, which meant a lot of pilpul, very sharp, not necessarily in immediate local atomic analysis, but they learned a lot, and they kept learning Kol Yemei Chayayim. So they would pick up, a London of this kind wouldn't work through defining, through the attempt to define and conceptualize the local themes and issues through the Rishonim. But he worked through comparisons of texts from all over Shas. So it required tremendous memories and tremendous keenness of association. In that keenness of association, which is called topu, pepper, there was a lot of brilliance, but there wasn't necessarily throughout consistent truth. It was sharp. It was fire. It's not the way the Goan learned. But the rest of Lithuania, for all of the fact that there was, that he caused a lot of asmoda to develop, until Valozhin came into its later decades, the Shittas HaPilpul was not supplanted in most of Lithuania by the new Derech. It was only Reb Chaim who really instituted it, and before him, the Netziv was a master of everything, tremendous Boki, but also not a conceptualizer. He was a Pashtun. He wanted to know Pshat in the text, Pshat in the text. But he knew Kalaperikula, and his, by the way, I have to tell you that the Netziv's great contribution was his comparison of Shas with the Medrash HaAlocha, with Safro, Safri, Mechilta, right? In order to learn Pshat in Shas, he brought to bear that he knew all of the sources of Shas, not just comparative texts, but he was a Pashtun Ga'oni, but his union was Pshat. The Chaim made conceptualization prevalent in the world of the Lithuanian yeshivas. But at the time that we're talking, the first decades of the century, well I shouldn't say it was, if you're talking about the Parkuf, the Jewish dates, it was the last decades of that century. What ruled was Pilpul. Why do I emphasize this? What? I said, again, who?
First one, just before Abraham?
Before Abraham, the Netziv. So the Netziv of Valozhin did not conceptualize. Before, but Rabbi Soil grew up in a pilpul world, very fiery, very sharp, knew everything, as the classic saying goes, he could put an elephant through an eye of a needle. He was resourceful yet full of initiative. He became dissatisfied. He felt something was wrong. This was the beginning of the revolution in his own life, which later caused him to try to mount a revolution elsewhere.
Where did they live?
They lived in Galicia. They lived far away from the Lithuanian sea. Galicia was Austria-Hungary for the First World War. It was a dismembered part of Poland, which in 1796 was divided three ways. There were two partitions. So one part went into Russia, one part it was absorbed by Germany, and one of Kiveya's part of Poland became German, and Galicia became Austria-Hungary. But it was southern Poland.
Yeah. That was more like Western Europe or Eastern Europe?
No, it was Eastern Europe. It's there that Hasidus enjoyed its greatest victories, though the Tzos and the Mechas Chinuch were not Hasidus. But the style of learning in Galicia, everywhere around them, was not conceptual. They were. Now, they were not as keenly conceptual as Reb Chaim. But the whole background, the whole plowing of, you know, until a shita acquires, I would say, not just prominence, until it's accepted, and then until it's required, prominence becomes prevalent, it's like in any sphere of knowledge or technology, there's a lot of preparation, a lot of plowing the ground that has to take place. They were such harshim. They plowed the ground of learning, and as a matter of fact, it tells that Ktzas HaCharshim was the most popular sefer. They used to say that if somebody would, the bochur would go out for walks and couldn't tear themselves away from a Ktzas. Somebody said that if somebody were an outsider would go take a walk in the fields around Tells, you could smell the fragrance of the Ktzas. Wherever you went, you heard Ktzas. So it became, but that was transcultural, you know, different countries. But, you know, the Torah is international.
And that was the beginning of the Ktzas in the 1800s?
Beginning of the 1800s, 1820, 1830s. That's when they were functioning. Now, but Rabbi Soil is a product, and for 18 years he was a product of the pilpulship. Came dissatisfied.
How did Reb Chaim Valozhin?
What? Pshat. The Netziv must have learned from what I gather and what one hears, like a Chaim. A Chaim was a Pshat one. Nu kola tera kula, but everywhere. He wanted an Ovo Shteida, what's written. And that he was Mekabel from the Groh. That emphasis, we have to mention that the Groh saw that insistence on Pshat and the hope that it would become widely prevalent as the major key for healing any of the psychological, spiritual, of the spiritual illnesses of the age. That was his answer to Haskola, to learn the Torah truthfully. Truth, not brilliance. Now, it goes without saying that he had more brilliance than anybody else, but he wasn't looking to scintillate, to shine. He wasn't looking to, you know, there was no artificial glow over there. Of course, in the history of our people, of Klal Yisrael, in the history of Torah among us, when you later compare, you can only do it retroactively, what was happening in the world around us, the type of challenge that was already present and that was coming, you see that the Hashgacha brought it about that the great teachers of Torah should everywhere somehow, whether they did it consciously or not, anticipate some type, they forged responses in anticipation to a certain type of challenge that came from around them. But I don't want to belabor this further. They became dissatisfied with themselves. And at that juncture in his life, he started taking note of one of the Lamdim in Salant who had been a Talmud in Reb Chaim, Reb Zundel Salant. And he began to suspect that this Reb Zundel was hiding himself. He watched and he watched, and just somehow he seemed like it was a tzaddik nister, it was a goy in Olam, and nobody ever knew about it. We didn't dress with any kind of rabbinic style. We wore a peltzel, they say, in a little leather coat, like small townspeople. None of the trappings of office around him. And one day, and the soul was magnetically drawn after him, followed him on a walk at some distance, thinking that Reb Zundel wasn't noticing him, and he wanted to see, where's he going to now, what's he going to do? Just his curiosity, well, the Ruchni is the curiosity, became a magnet. He's following him. All of a sudden, on this walk, Reb Zundel turns around and looked him in the eyes, and he said to him, Zundel, you want to be a Yirei Shemayim? Yisrael, you want to be a Yirei Shemayim? We'll send a Yirei Shemayim. Lechem Musa. That's all he said to him. Yisrael later related that it was like a fire. His whole life changed course. A few words, he decided then and there he has to become a different type of Jew. So then he started applying himself to break with people radically. Everything has extremes. Everything has moderated forms. At that point, he felt so strongly that he had gone on a wrong path, but he just wouldn't hear of anything other than Pshat. I have to stop at this moment, and I have to tell you something about what happened in relation to his shivus, which happened a few years earlier than this. I want to bring this in, so that you should hear how much Musa's sensitivity there was even before it became a shidduch, in those areas. A shidduch was talked for him with a certain girl. Forget, you know, now names and father. Al Chocham, but he was a rich Jew. He was going to give 300 ruble the dirt. Now, so that this young man should be able to sit and learn. 300 ruble was a sizable sum of money. Then it turned out that he became poor. He became a Yoreh, then he's the Yoreh ben Achosa. Lost his possessions, lost his money, and a certain other Gevir in another city became aware of this and did the following. He took himself to this Mechutin, knowing that he was broken-hearted and he couldn't possibly meet his commitment. he went to him, the other Jew, and he said to him, look, I will give you, I think it was 10,000 people, that you should be marshal. You should be marshal the Shiva. And I'll take care of him, I don't know, he said, the rest of his life. I'll do everything, you know, that needs to be done for such a genius. I was a genius already, young boy. And maybe it's better for him if a cloudy soil that you should be marshal. Broken-hearted, this Jew goes himself to young Yisrael's father, and he tells his father the whole Maisa, and he says, look, I have to tell you the truth, I'm not able to meet my mother today. As we've shown that Yisrael should be left because of it, should have to go become a red man after some trade or whatever was possible, and I should go away from prayer. And I have such and such an offer. No, maybe it was, no, the opposite. That other Jew was going to give, I thought that you're mistaken, I never was faulty. He was going to give the initial mechutin a handsome sum of money, whatever he wanted, to be Mephias him. He should forego it. And he was willing to give Yisrael as a nadin 10,000 rubles instead of 300 rubles. He went to him, and that mechutin himself went afterwards to Yisrael, to the chosen's father, and to the chosen to tell them, I can't do what I was committed to do, but look, Hashgacha is watching over you, and such an offer is being made to you by so and so. So I'm willing to be my friend. You know what Yisrael's father did? He ran over to the closet, pulled out whiskey, and said, called in his wife and some cookies. The shidduch hadn't yet been finalized. He pulled some cookies and he called his wife in, and he grabbed hold of the chutney and told him, Mazel tov, mechitten, Mazel tov. And the boy also, I mean, they weren't going to. Yes, money, no money. That's how people set themselves on the task of learning a whole life without kolos stipend to speak up. By the way, it was Rabbi Yisrael who in his later years made it possible that the first kolos should begin. Although it wasn't in his own lifetime, but there was a certain an elderly bocher. Was his name in Germany? He was in Germany. Who was a great Talmid Torah, and he started the first Kollel together with Rabbi Tzvi Petra, but there was one of the Talmidim of Rabbi Yisrael. But this whole Indian of raising up Talmid Torah and looking to get away from Teg for eating days, and establishing Limud Torah for Avreichim the COVID, it was all pressed for that. I'll go upon it, but that's a later Indian. That's a little bit of a I want to call it, it's not an anecdote, Kalila. It's a tidbit that shows us and gives us a little bit of a flash into the inner life of these people. Al Koponim, we'll come back now. After he got to know Reb Zundel, Reb Yisrael spent 2.5 years reviewing all of his attitudes and outlooks and all of his hashpachasai. In these 2.5 years, he tried to study all the sources of Torah in all of his areas, and Alocha, and Agoda, and Emias HaTorah, in order to reshape and to formulate clearly his path for the future. During this time, he became, for the first time, critical of his surroundings. Now, I mean this now, I don't want to say sociologically, you didn't think in those terms. But he looked at the Chevra HaYehudis, at the Chevra HaToranis around him, and he saw things that became deeply disturbing. He saw a lot of Ahavas Torah. He saw a lot of Chesed. He saw a lot of Yirat Shamayim. He saw that there was a certain selectivity of emphasis in the Yirat Shamayim of the world of some things, Baruch Hamas, that happened up to here. Kashrus was then at a level that a Jew who suspected Chalila that he had eaten the slightest bit of a davar ha'asur would get sick much. But he also saw that the Ben Adam HaChavera Matzah was very uneven. Side by side with a lot of chesed, yes, there was a lot. But side by side with that, there was also kalus rosh, levity about use of the tongue, about lashon hara, about business manners, cutting a corner. A little bit later, there was a further development of this critical attitude which deeply burned in him. He became aware that in one area of life and death, that the gevirim, the wealthy, who usually were the top leadership of the kehillahs, did things that, in his estimate, touched on a given, you know, basic Torah approaches to life, that touched on shvichas damim, that touched on ritzicha, that touched on terrible exploitation of the weakness of others, namely, the you heard of the chotfim, the 25-year, these Russian children that were taken captive, and not just taken captive, each kehillah had to supply a certain number. So the gevirim bought their way out for their children. What did the Rosh HaKol do? All too often, didn't do it everywhere, but all too often, if they couldn't meet the quota, they would put their eyes on some yosem, some child of an almono who was defenseless. On one occasion, Abisor came to a town, and one such almono, whose child had just been grabbed away from her a few days earlier and was still in an army base in the area, they were sent away for 25 years. He's in the thousands, in the tens of thousands. But again, you're talking about a 9 million, you know, a Jewish population then. This almona came to where Yisrael was staying. She threw herself at his feet and sobbed out what had happened to her, that her child had been snatched from her, a young boy, and was still in the, you know, in the army base not far from town, and she was going mad with grief. And this was, I think it was a Thursday night, so I told her to be calm. Shabbos, he was invited to a kiddush in the home of one of the leading wealthy people in town, and the whole, you know, the who is who of the town was there at the table. Ran after them, made a bracha, you know, there's a lechayim, and said, "Baruch and a mezonos." Rabbi Yisrael leaped to his feet, and he started wildly screaming, "You're a shayna yidin, you're a rotzchim!" I don't remember the exact words, either he screamed, "Osa lehistakel b'chnei rosha," or some similar manner, and ran out of the room. They say, either he said it, or he said it later, like as if a snake had been. And everybody ran after him, you know, to pacify him. Everybody knew, but then it was already a world door. And he said, "Until you take that child out of their hands and bring him back here, I don't want to see any of you. I don't want to know anything." But it wasn't the solution to the problem. But the Israel couldn't live with this was an extreme example, the discrepancy between a great deal of Yiras Shamayim and Ahavas Torah in some areas, and in some areas, like sad gaps in the Ben Adam L'Chaverah sphere of Torah. He also noted, there were other things that he noted. He noted that many of the young people were in a state of extreme unrest, of disquiet. Best minds were running away, were looking to get away. He didn't agree with the way of just suppressing inner protest or you know, what the Haskalah worked on, what the Haskalah tried to drum up, and the from world. What was its reaction? Don't read a book, don't do this, don't do that, don't talk to so-and-so. That to him also was something that was not an answer, because whatever might be the case with reference to each yachid, that each yachid was precious, but he didn't hold that it was an answer, certainly, to the enormous challenge that he saw more and more clearly was rolling in from the west. I've jumped ahead a little bit, because what I've told you now, even though it developed of this thread, and this thought, the feeling, and this attitude, became a thick cord, a thick rope years later, but its beginnings were during these 2.5 years. 2.5 years, an accomplished young Goyen sits and does nothing else other than to re-examine all of his presuppositions. After those 2.5 years, he was already set on his path. By then, he had come to the conclusion that the limud of Musar, not just as a continuation of the methods of all the classic Bava Musar, but with a new style and method and technique, had to be made an integral part of the Torah curriculum of adults and youngsters, of men and women. Like he held that this was the one area of Torah which was equally binding, that if there was no time for anything else, that this one area of Torah was equally binding on London and simple Jew, on child and adult, on men and women. What was this limit? There weren't Musar Svarim before. There was the Chavos Avodos, and there was the Ochos Tzadikim, and there was the Rabbeinu Yonah, and there was the Shavua HaKodesh, and the Domayu, and tens of more of these, for whom there was endless reverence in the Jewish world, always. What? I'm sorry, did I miss something? Okay. But that limud was not seen as an integral limud that you should have to spend hours a day on it, that you should have to work at it, to turn it into, to internalize it, to make it a major part of your program of becoming a Jew. How was it learned till then? Even those who learned it regularly would learn a little bit before limud, before learning Gemara. 15 minutes in the morning, 15 minutes in the evening. People learned. But the learning was for iyun, for the sake, with the hope, of acquiring inspiration by acquiring knowledge. They learned the Chavos Avodos and Svarim like that to know what's the truth, what does he teach. And if we'll know what he teaches, so sooner or later we'll take it to heart. It'll memela become internalized. Rabbi Yisrael did not hold that it would memela become internalized. It was so held that it had to be worked at with a new method and a new technique. Well, how was he going to... See, I skip a lot now of the history of his life, I'll come back to. How was he going to get other Jews to join him, accept his views? How was he going to disseminate this approach? How was he going to turn it into a regular program? He went through several experimental stages in this. I have not yet told you what the major ingredient was, not just in form. I said that he held that you have to make it an integral part. But how? How? I haven't told you that at all yet. But first I want to get to his attempts at making it, at turning it from a personal experience and a personal conviction into a movement. So first, he thought the way was for him to become a magid, and he started traveling, and in order to give it respectability, he started saying shiurim in aloha in order to show off, so that everybody should know that the person behind this is a goyim of world proportions. The feirish, he departed from his own, he had for so many years suffered. You know, the soul language of transforming, of sublimating all of his, you know, it's natural that if a person, you know, is a goyim intellectually, that he wants to shine sometimes. So first he broke that in himself. And then he decided, for the sake of this cause, people had to know that the person behind, the individual behind this new shitta, was himself a goyim whom nobody could dismiss on the grounds that he wasn't enough of a goyim. He started with Magidus, saying Droshes, a new style in Droshes. The earlier Droshes, by the way, just like the Musar Svarim were learned only for the ideas in them, the earlier Droshes were agadic people. They weren't given, they weren't organized expositions of Musaf themes. They weren't attempts to inspire to certain particular, to certain tikkun of midis. There was Moshe, yeah? I mean, the Maggid would give them fire and brimstone over some kilkulim that there might have been in one area. Maybe they didn't daven with sufficient warmth, or with sufficient ispalos, or sufficient, I would say, slavos. So, or in one another area, there would be something that was thought missing in the sphere of tzniyos or klas hamishpacha. The Musa was fire and brimstone, one second, but it was pilpul. So it didn't instruct, elevate, edify. On one side of there. But how were they used? Jews learned Yaras Vash. Right? 15 minutes Yaras Vash, and how before Purim is a big inyan of Yaras Vash and all the Astoras and Megillas Esther. Good. So you even learned the Yaras Vash. But methods that they should elevate and inspire. And not just inspire emotionally alone, but through a total illumination of areas that needed inner development. That was not the method and style of the Maggid. So either it was fire and brimstone, or else it was cold pilpul, but not an aloha in agoda. So Jews would sit there, they loved Torah, so you got to listen to the Maggid. He would hammer away for 2 hours, so if it was fire and brimstone, they all cried. But if it was a pilpul and agoda, so after 2 or 3 minutes, you know, all 500 Jews lost it. Because they were not London, the people for whom the Maggidim needed to speak. We're not talking about Valoshin, we're talking about the state, like with the simple Jews. Al Koponin, he developed a new technique in the drasha. His drasha was given in Yiddish and based a lot, of course, on exposition of classic texts, were expositions. Organized, illuminating, relevant to the soul issues of the day. There's a new kind of public discourse. Well, but the movement wasn't born yet. There was no movement yet. So you started thinking, what else could I do? What else could I do? Maybe I could organize groups of Balabatim whom I could convince to start pursuing this limud the way I hold they should learn it. So he established in Kavna, tried to establish Musa Shtiblech. Musa Shtiblech were places. There's one Beis HaMusar in Yerushalayim today, by the way. Somewhere near Ezra's Torah over there, that's where it is. Every once in a while there are Sikhas over there, I think every week. What's a Beis HaMusar? Large number of Musaf Svarim available from all times and places. Absolute, no outside intrusion, no distractions, seriousness, a place for aloneness, a place for his bodidus, a place to learn Musaf, to feel Musaf, to think Musaf, for groups of Jews to meet. Either individually or together, to hear sikhas of the type that we will soon describe, and he hoped that this would be the foundation of the Judaism. He became, after a while, sadly disappointed. Became convinced that people who have already reached a certain establishment and they become habituated to their ways, since the thrust of Musa was to turn the insides over, uproot the old midas and transformed it. That with Balabatim, even if they were London, even if they were Yirei Hashem, but they were already no longer in the formative stages but in the settled stages. Besides the fact that all of the problems of life and the distractions of life and the troubles of living in an anti-Semitic Russia and the troubles of Parnosis being under constant tension and being broken repeatedly, in addition to all that, the strength of habit, it militated against the chances of a new Musa Shita, that it should become a movement. So he came to the conclusion that the way to do it is for him to become a mashgiach in a yeshiva or in yeshivas. So he offered himself to become the Menaruch Liyavaloshin. And he was not accepted. By then, when Chaim Riske was a young man, he was there already, he was the rising star of conceptualization. He did not agree that Musa would do the trick for such a Yechidim, would do it, would accomplish. He held that only learning, straight learning, would accomplish what needed to be accomplished. And he told Rabbi Yisrael, Musa is for sick people. We in Volozhin are healthy. We won't go into the Holy Land. We will judge between the two. So Rabbi Yisrael was left from there. And in time, he acquired a number of individual Talmidim in Vilna and in Kalna, great individual Talmidim, didn't have any formal base, any formal platform. He was determined all of his life not to be dependent on anybody else for a livelihood, so he refused to become a Rav. He was once a Rosh Yeshiva for a brief period of time in Vilna, in Rav Milas' Yeshiva, whose last Rosh Yeshiva was Rav Gusman. It was Rav Gusman, Hashem Yomot. And then there was another Goyim who was Rosh Yeshiva there, Mokhamadze. So Salanta was invited to become a fellow, you know, joint Rosh Yeshiva. After a while, Rabbi Yisrael noted, started seeing that most of the Talmidim were being drawn away from Rav Mokhamadze's Shiur and the Goyim himself, and were drawn to Rabbi Yisrael. And one day he picked up and left the Yeshiva. He wouldn't be a rov, he wouldn't be, he refused his whole life. Also would not take money from private people except from several handpicked Talmidim from whom he took never more than the barest necessities of life. He was nifter. Didn't leave a room. So that's nothing. Yeah.
What was the time frame of this?
The time frame is now, by now, in other words, this development of his looking through, it's the 1840s, 1850s. This is where he's looking to establish the movement. That's the time frame.
So in the course of his life, though, he started when he was 32 or 33.
Yeah, and later, you'll soon hear what happened.
Until his first Talmidim?
That's right. In other words, he only had, in effect, in Russia, private Talmidim who developed followings and who developed Musa yeshivas. Musa became a prevalent in the yeshivas, never became widespread in the kehillas, but in the yeshivas it became widespread, and then it became prevalent after his p'tir. It was only in Kelem and in Slabodka later. Kelem was there during his time. There was a Beis HaMusar in Kelem, but it was not a major institution. And Volozhin kept it out. It wasn't until after the closing of Volozhin. Rabbi Yisrael was already been there for a number of years. A few years later, Slabodka opened up. And a few years before that, the Bitzel of Petterburg had managed to establish a Musa Kailu in Kovna, which Rabbi Yitzchok Chanan in part headed up, but which Rabbi Yitzchok Chanan's son fought against. Rabbi Yitzchok Chanan's son, Rabbi Hirsch, was a Goyim Olam himself and a great tzaddik, and he and some other Goyim in Litta, we'll come to that, held that the Muslim movement had to be stopped. They fought it hard. It wasn't until, what? Not openly. Rabbi Yitzchok Chanan stood with them, but didn't foster it. Rabbi Yitzchok Chanan was not, if he was a misnagid, he was a misnagid in here and in here. But around him, there were Goyim, especially after this Petira, who came out blazing against the Musa movement. You come to that. Go ahead, anything that Adam Bishai. Yeah.
Alluded a couple times to a connection between the more conceptual approach of Reb Chaim, not being related to some of an anti-Lucifer, and Reb Yisrael being the Pashtun, and that
not because of
him
that.
Towards
no,
any
no,
connection.
No, there's no connection. Aside from the method of learning which Reb Chaim initiated and disseminated, Reb Chaim held that it was only the glow of halachic learning that could heal the soul of individuals around. He held that any method extraneous to the inner learning of Shas conceptually, it might in the short run you know, have great accomplishments, but in the long run, it would not solve the problems of the age.
Yeah. It should be mentioned that along with the emphasis on the study of the Musar text, Trudeau also felt very strongly that those sections of halakha that relate to interpersonal ethics need to be emphasized. So I'm just saying that idea of Rabbi Sol certainly could not be subject to any of the criticism on the part of the Volozhin community or anyone else.
It was deeply subject, because he held that that learning Musa for his fathers hours a day, that would do it. It wasn't that the information conveyed in the texts that Rabbi Sol wanted to emphasize. That wasn't what bothered the anti-Musa people.
No, I understand, but I'm saying Rabbi Yisrael emphasized the need to study the halachic, to study the halachos of interpersonal ethics.
And economic, but they didn't single that out as a special limud with special emphasis. They held that you learn kol ha'Torah kula, and that's what he is. So, if you need a tikkun avada, need a tikkun, so Bala Musa have to come and talk to this tzibur or that tzibur or this yachar or that, be misakin yourself. But not that if he's going to spend hours a day working on betochen, with exercises and with techniques and with methods to arouse one's emotions while he's learning these inyonim. See, those inyonim that other Rabbi Yisrael held, that the first principle is to learn the halachas of the inyon on which you have to learn Musa. But after that, you have to learn Musa by plunging yourself into an ocean. The ocean was opposed to. Not because, again, it wasn't a doctrinal difference. It wasn't a different outlook on Yadus. They both agreed that the Ben Adam L'Chaveira in Yonim needed Tikkun. How would they come to Tikkun? They were not going to come to Tikkun. Valojin held through the Musa movement. But I want to get back first. I haven't gone in, you noticed, into any attempts to define yet the inner Shidda. I haven't tried that yet. I want to get to that in the last moments that we'll have. But Poshet is life. His life. He's trying organizationally to get this shit off the ground. When did it get off the ground, really? It was the end of his life, the Kovna Kolel, which was fought, and the Beis HaMusar, the Beis HaTalmud, some people called it the Talmud Torah of Kelev. The Kelev of Talmud Torah, which Rav Simcha Zissel, Ziv, who was one of his three greatest Talmidim, established in Kelev, which incidentally was also an experiment, both in Musa and an experiment in Teirim Derech Eretz, at a lower level. It was the only place where, you know, a goyim of that age attempted to establish a school where there would be limudim klolim in the yeshiva. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter never himself set foot in the institution. And he said that the only reason he gave the shuster of some chazisel to open it was that he was sure that if it would be necessary to close it, if Kilkulim would come out of it, Rav Simcha Zissel would close it. At a later time, I'm going to try to give you a little bit of a picture of what that Talmud, it was called the Talmud Torah, but it was really a place from here to there. What it looked like, what its whole inner mood was, what its style was, what anybody would see who would come in there. Hold your thoughts for a moment, just. So, it's there. It was in the Kovna Kolel, and then in Slabodka, which was in which in one of the two yeshivas in Slabodka. It was in Slabodka, in the yeshiva that was established as a Musa yeshiva, and in which the Lubavitch Mordechai was the Rosh Yeshiva, and the Mashgiach was Rav Moshe Hirsch, the Rautef of Slabodka, who was like a Talmud Chover. He was a Talmud Chover of Rav Simcha Zissel. Didn't agree with Rav Simcha Zissel in many things, but in many inyonim, he followed him, and he established the first large-scale Musa Yeshiva. As a result of the closing of Alojin, Slabodka became the model for the later yeshivas. And from there, we'll come to that, how it happened, Musa started spreading to the other major yeshivas. Came to Mir with more or less success at first, not until Rav Yeruchim came to Mir. Years and years later did Mir become a real Musa yeshiva. It tells there were desperate battles. And in those battles, the Ponovich Jerome Zichron Lebracha, as a young boy, almost ended up a maskil and almost ended up a communist. And the Chofetz Chaim saved him. He was part of that war. He was used by the rebels against Moshe. He was the biggest, possibly the biggest Iloi I don't know if I have a right to say it. One of the big Iluyim in Telz. So when the anti-Musar Talmidim broke away from Telz, they took him with them, and he became the Magid Shia for them. And after that, Kol HaMinim Ulchomis enveloped him and surrounded him. And he was saved somehow. Many were not. One of the Talmidim who turned sour then was a later Matamnik by the name of Avraham Hertzfeld, who had been a Chaver or a Chavrus of the Kavajor. And that guy turned into a radical, radical apocalypse. 50 years later, that Avraham Hertzfeld made it possible for Panovar Jerome to establish Panovar Jerome. Didn't become a Chumayid, but he resolved he must help him. So he opened the doors, and you never can tell, he opened the doors of the Medina and of the ministries, and that was at a time of Ben Gurion's regime. It was a very heavy year, anti-Dat. And yet, you never could tell how things twirl, how they turn. Want to get back. At a certain stage, Rabbi Sol Salanter was offered the headship of a new Mesemenesh Rabbonim, a rabbinical theological seminary, which the Russian government and the Maskilim were interested in establishing in Vilna. The Maskilim had a notion that the Yisrael could be won to their cause, because wasn't he emphasizing humanism? Wasn't he emphasizing Benot HaMachaveira? Wasn't he emphasizing a certain kind of culture which episodically old from Yeshivish world then? Mr. Medrash was not known, was not accepted. Wasn't he at heart, maybe, one of them? Couldn't be anybody who was as powerful in his opposition to them as he was. Yeah, so they saw he's rebelling and they're rebelling. So he's Mishalon of Yisrael. Okay. So they decide to press him, together with the Russian government, that he should become the head of this new rabbinical theological seminary that was going to produce a completely new type of Rav for Russian Jewry. And little by little, they were going to remove the old leadership. It would take a generation or two. And Rabbi Yisrael would be the, would be the Gabel over this. So Rabbi Yisrael said no, and then pressures of whose character we don't know exactly what sort of pressures were brought to bear on him. One nice day, he vanished, just fled Vilna. And he went to another province where there was another governor, Gubernia it was called. He went to Kovna, he was then for years had been living in Vilna, and he ran away. I will not go into now into what it was, that why he was so opposed. Why he ran away, we know. He didn't want to be pressured into becoming a tool of the Haskalah against the whole Tertal world then, and against the whole of Russian Jewry, which is largely a Tertal community. Yeah. Not that he, no, he would be used as a tool. Even if he wouldn't give him personally.
But he wasn't have any connection with
it. But he held that there was no way that that kind of school could produce real Tavir HaKafam and real Rabbonim. Even if it were to remain true. Not that he would yield anything. He held that that style of chinuch could not produce real Tamir HaKhovet. And it couldn't produce real Rabbonim. So it would only be a cover-up. It would be a camouflage for something else. There was another such experiment in Zhitomir, in which whose colors came through clearly. The person who headed up the Talmud department in Zhitomir was a big lump. He was the author of the first sefer that attempted to make shalom between the Chassidim and the Mishnayim and the Haskalah. It was called Shalom Ad Yisrael. Get his name now. Get his name, Shalom Ad Yisrael. He with a big beard, and he was a lump, most often. He grieved over what happened there, but he ended up a tool. Yisrael was too big to become a tool. Ran away because they brought pressures. And it was already dangerous for him to resist. He didn't just resist such an offer and such pressures. He gets himself to Kovna, runs away, and a short while later, he decides, famous Moshel, he decides that when a wagon is running downhill, so you can't stop the horses
by running up from the bottom of the hill and going like this. The horses will crush you. And he came to the conclusion that Russian Jewry could only be saved by an effort from outside Russian Jewry. Imagine that. There were millions upon millions of Jews from the Yidden. He already held that his work could not succeed unless it had support from an outside source. Where could he work? Strange to tell, what he really banked on was that he could produce, through a new tshuva movement, a new kind of purity and spirituality, which would become a challenge and an inspiration to that then enormous big world of Frum from birth, and like the Torah from birth, and Yirei Shemayim from birth, but who were already hardened in their ways. So it needed something from where? From Germany, from France. Most of his life afterwards was already spent in Germany and France. He began to live in Königsberg for 10 years. Started working with students. Had an enormous impact on him. Yeah. Königsberg was already in Germany. He was careful not to say to Lithuanian Jews from his... I described to you the geographic area where he lived, that there was a lot of give and take, travel, commerce. Whenever he saw a Lithuanian Jew in the Beis HaMedrash in Königsberg, he would fold up, wouldn't say, wouldn't talk. Because these needed to hear something different than those needed to hear. And there were all sorts of stories how he would plead with somebody to smoke one cigarette less next Shabbos. It's Shabbos, that kind of stuff. He taught businessmen who had to unload. There was a port city, Königsberg. So they had to unload their loads. So he said, to unload on Shabbos, you can't escape. But let's see how many derises you can avoid. So he chipped them down. There were hundreds of Jews who became Shemra Mitzvah. But his ikir impact was on students. He met one long night with Rav Shamshon Avraham Hirsch and with Rav Meir Lehman. I don't know if it was in Berlin. I think it was in Berlin. And he went through the 19 letters in translation from the German. And he then came to the conclusion that the Sefer needed translation into Hebrew. And he spearheaded it, even though it didn't come to pass in his time, but the late 1880s, two Yidden, one Rav Shlomo Zalman Aronson, and one who was one of the Rosh Yeshivas in Telz then, did the first two works in Lashon HaKodesh based on Hirsch. One was Meitav Vigoyen, I think it was Hirsch's one. And one, Meitav Vigoyen is a sort of a condensation and a redoing of some of the basic ideas of Hirsch and Chumash. But the Yeres Safon, that was translated by a certain Talmud Chacham in Vilna, with Haskamas from the Yitzchok Chonon, later from Reb Chaim Moisek, Haskamas were given then to the Pirush of Hirsch and Torah, which is Moshe HaKadosh, called Nachlas Tzvi, which Reb Yitzchok Chonon gave a glowing Haskama to it, even though he couldn't learn it. Didn't read it because didn't know German. I wasn't going to go translating in a whole five volumes like that, six volumes at that time. Al Kaponim, but he was so moved by its contents that he then wrote that it was necessary for all of the works of Hirsch to be translated into Lashon HaKodesh. He also undertook then to get Shas translated into a number of European languages, and he attempted to establish cathedras in Judaic studies in German universities. He held that if this effort would succeed, and the learning of Talmud would become, on the part of Jewish semi or totally assimilated students, would become respectable. So this whole stream of yeshiva bachrim and shtibel bachrim running from the shtiblech and from the yeshivas, they would meet a world which would say to them, what are you guys running for? You know, it's doing over here. You just didn't learn it right. We have something of a similar happening in our times, that I don't want to expand on too much, but you're aware, I'm sure, what I mean. You know, when you get somebody who's been there already, and he starts saying, or a few hundred or a few thousand, and they start saying, wow, there's nothing that compares in that world to this Rashbo. So then, some yeshiva bacher, you know, who has become already, you know, Mitzvah Samoshim Olamada style, and he's tearing at the reins because he wants out and he wants out, and he comes upon some of these chevre and he sees a world of this kind, it has an effect. He was hoping for more than this. He was hoping for a top flight respectability to come in academic circles. The big Yetzirah then wasn't the Yetzirah of our day. It wasn't a cheap, vulgar Yetzirah. There was an intellectual Yetzirah. And this kind of limud could become accepted and respected in those halls of the kind of Western secular learning which in their heart of hearts, you know, every second yeshiva bocher had that Yetzirah tugging at him. If only he could get to Heidelberg or Berlin. Well, if he would find, you know, something like this happening there, it didn't work. We found out after a while that the people doing the translation, when they got to the Agodis, that they tampered with the Agodis, that they that the notes that were written, the commentaries that began to be written, were Haskalic in nature, and were headed towards a completely non-Torah approach to Shas. He stopped. I remember now another thing, I couldn't remember the name for a while. He had a top Talmud, an Ilyotzer, by the name of Einhorn, whom he sent himself to the University of St. Petersburg in the hope that he would become the first model of a Talmud Chacham who would be, you know, master of Shas and the Yerei Shemayim, and would succeed at the highest levels of the Russian academic world. And that would be an example. That individual, that Einhorn, was a cultman of the effort, and he became the later, I think, general surgeon of the Russian army, General Einhorn. He became a bishop. He sort of pulled back. I gave you a lot, you know, in a few sentences. These are years of efforts. Pulled back brokenhearted, and he walked away from the attempt, you know, at Kira by reaching out. Started reaching in. Then he turned his attention a little. But he dressed German style when he was there. He understood German well. He could make himself understood. His manner was impeccably Western when he was. It's interesting to note, unlike his own behavior, God would be sort of a Ukrainian sort. Nobody could catch him not dressed according to the latest conservative fashion, no Rabbanish clothing. When he was there, you know, he looked like a German aristocrat, Lahavdil. Goes to Paris and he sees something else is happening that begins to bother him greatly. I'm going to stop here in a minute right now. He saw the beginnings of the Hagira, of the great immigration, right after the 1881. He saw that Jews are going out of this world, out of this country, out of this old Russian Empire. And who knows where they're headed for? Now, how far are they going? Some are going to America. Maybe it can be staved off. Some are going to England. Well, in England, the Mosnadlo was there. Didn't succeed too much, but the Mosnadlo was a girl who saw it. The founder of the United Synagogue, founder of the London Besen, founder of what later became Jews College, but was originally a faultlessly Torah Jew institution. So he's not headed for London, but in Paris, he discovers that there are some hundreds or already thousands of migrants who are from the Yemen and have no leadership. What will happen to them could be a forerunner of what's going to happen to unknown masses, unknown numbers of masses of Russian and Polish and Lithuanian and Galician Jews are going to be headed away from the earlier motherland, and who knows, maybe they'll get across the ocean. Has to establish something. So in his old age, he takes himself to Paris, doesn't know French, doesn't know the language, and organizes the first Torah Truth Kehillah of East European Jews in France, and brought over a leading Rov, I believe was, if I'm not mistaken, was a Polish Chassidish Rov, but brought him over to be the Rov of that Kehillah, and while there, he had a terrible accident. He fell down a flight of stairs once. He was not well. He was alone. He ended up going back. I believe that he was Niftar in Kenningsburg, never made it back to Russia. During all of these years, he would visit Russia occasionally, kept up a very close correspondence with all of his leading public. How he was lifted, this I must tell you, though I can't get into the ship, and you really have to put We'll be back 2 weeks from tonight. It's very important to be done right. I don't want to do it just a finger and walk away from it. On the day of his p'tira, there was one alone Shabbos who was with him. And he saw, felt his kavod going, and his family wasn't there. One of his children, by the way, in his lifetime, turned away from Yiddishkeit. Another was a big one. Children of that one who turned away from Yiddishkeit ended up in America establishing, already as assimilated Jews, the ethical culture movement. The head of the ethical culture movement was an Adler, its founder in America. And Shosalante, his name for certain reasons was Lipkin, and for certain reasons changed to Adler.
Felix Adler
was a great grandson. Was a grandson or a great grandson? Mrs. De Sola Poole had a sister. She was the wife of the rabbi of the Spanish culture. She had a sister who was a top leader of that movement. And look how full of this. It was also not the move heaven and earth that the son who ended up in a university and ended up going away from Shiva's HaMitzvahs, he moved heaven and earth that without his knowledge that son should be at least fed kosher food. Didn't give up on anybody. The day of his death, the last hours, he felt the end is coming. What does he worry about in such a thing? That this poor Shamus shouldn't be frightened and upset too much by death. The last Masasifa consisted of Chizuk and the Chama given to this Shamus with his last purpose, that there really isn't too much to be afraid of within the presence of the dying Christ. Not to be afraid even if the person dies, until he calmed him down again. That was his last concern, that another Yid shouldn't suffer any mental anguish over his last kaiches, in other words, he's departing from life. Dinav Shetzvel B'Zarachai. Yes, Hashem, next week in Purim. And then 2 weeks from tonight, we'll take a look at Rabbi Shlomo Shiff.